Historian Belinda Jack's new book, The Woman Reader, is a study of women's reading over the centuries and the forces which opposed it. It's a vast undertaking with lots of case histories, and in about 300 pages she covers Paleolithic wall paintings to 21st century reading groups. So who is the woman reader and how has she changed? Here's Belinda Jack speaking with Kate Evans about her work.
I mean, I think that there has always been a deep suspicion of the woman reader, and so all sorts of forces preventing women from reading. And those forces have been both material and psychological. So material in the sense that women have been denied education or denied access to libraries. But at the same time, there are the psychological forces. I mean, the idea that this goes right back to the Roman times. I mean, Juvenal wrote a satire in the first century AD called Against Women, in which he mocks women who can quote lines from poetry that he doesn't know himself, and talks about the intellectual woman as a snake, as poison, and so on. So those forces have certainly been at work. But I have uncovered huge numbers of stories about feisty women who were immensely committed to women reading, people like Elizabeth Fry, who was a Quaker in the 19th century and who used to go regularly to Newgate Prison to read to women. So all manner of stories of women who weren't prepared to put up with those forces trying to prevent women from becoming literate and entering the world of reading and knowing that it was going to be a source of liberation for so many women if they were able to read.
But tracking reading rather than writing isn't always easy. How much harder is it to find the woman reader?
Well, it's very much harder than I realised when I undertook to write my history of women's reading. The variety of sources that I've looked at is enormous and fascinating, from the iconography, looking at images of women reading, looking at correspondence, letter writing, that's been a very important source. Marginalia, particularly in the 18th century, some women readers were very happy to annotate the novels they read. I'm thinking in particular of Lady Bragg-Taigue, who was a great reader of Richardson's Clarissa and Pamela, and he actually asked her for her copies because she'd noted so much in the margins, and it was very useful market research as far as he was concerned.
And what image of her emerged from that marginalia?
Well, she had very strong views about what the novel should be, and I mean, their correspondence started very humorously when she wrote him saying, please spare your heroine from any calamity, and if you don't, I'll stop reading you. So she had very firm ideas about the novel, in some sense being quite a light-hearted genre, and she wanted happy endings.
But none of this is straightforward. There is no one sanctioned view of the woman reader in any period. In ancient Rome, for example, while one writer pilloried the educated woman, Ovid wrote for her, and upper-class men valued woman readers in their own circle as a sign of both education and leisure.
I think there are really quite close parallels between the Roman period and the 18th century, when, with the beginnings of the Industrial Revolution and as education started to spread, women readers were seen as of a higher status. And of course, you needed leisure time to read. And so in a sense, a woman reader was the opposite of the woman who had to get her hands dirty, who had to be working in a factory or a field. And so status has been closely associated with women readers. But at the same time, there have always been these boundaries. It's one thing to be a reader and another thing to write, for example. I mean, until the 19th century, women who who wrote because they wanted to make any money out of their writing were very much despised and often likened to prostitutes because of entering the public sphere and saying what they wanted to say.
And reading, rather than being read to, was an issue of power, control and interpretation for both men and women. Who had the right to read the Bible, for example, split entire countries and political systems apart?
Yes, I think the case of sort of religion and women's reading is a fascinating one and a very complex one, because obviously until the Reformation there's a sense in which in order to read the Bible, you had to be highly educated, you had to be a classicist in effect. And for a long time, that was seen as a way of controlling and regulating religion and the church. And then, of course, the Protestant Reformation was very much about making sure that Bibles were available in the vernacular, in everyday languages, so that everybody who was literate could actually read and interpret the Bible for themselves. And, of course, there were many who thought that that was a very dangerous thing.
You talk about reading being a revolutionary practice, but what is happening with the woman reader and with the practice of reading during the times that we identify as revolutionary?
Well, I think that's a really interesting question because I think it's during periods of political instability, during revolutions and sometimes during periods of instability because of famine or disease. It's at those more dramatic times that women are more able to operate in the public space as opposed to the private space of the home. So during those periods, women are out there more, they're much more involved, and that emerges in terms of their reading and in some cases their writing, their being able to put pen to paper and express their views. During periods of stability, it's more difficult for the woman reader by and large.
And then there's sex and sin. Reading as much more than a simple pleasure.
Yes, indeed, and I think it's very visible in the iconographic record. The range of images of women reading is just astonishing and wonderful, and it ranges from images of the Virgin Mary at the Annunciation when she's holding the book as a symbol of the law and when she submits to being the mother of Christ. So it's an immensely powerful image of a woman reader, even though we know that there's no mention of Mary being literate in the Bible. So that's the exemplary woman, and there she is with a book. And then at the opposite end of the spectrum, you get some extraordinary images of naked women reading, which are immensely erotically suggestive. And I'm thinking of one in particular by a Belgian painter called Wiertz, who painted this extraordinary image of a woman reclining on a bed with a mirror beside her, so you can see almost all of her naked body. And she's reading, lying back in a rather sort of sumptuous pillow. And beside her is a stack of novels. And then you notice, the last thing you notice is a little figure crouched behind the bed. And on his head there are little horns. And this is the devil pushing novels towards her to speed her on her way to perdition.
So what do you think that's about? I mean, is it just the privacy of reading and the potential masturbatory image, or that ideas, words, having any sort of private world is in itself threatening?
I think that's absolutely right. It's the idea that you're in a secret space as a reader. No one can see what you're thinking, how you're responding, how you're feeling when you read. And that, for many men and some women indeed, has really been a source of great anxiety. I mean, perhaps there's an implication that women, particularly reading the novel, become self-sufficient in some sense and don't need the men anymore. But it's really the novel that is particular in this respect. Women reading poetry, women reading plays, has never been seen as worrying as the novel. So it's really in the 19th century with the rise of women's literacy in many parts of the world and the novel taking over as the major literary genre. That's when there seems to be more and more concern about this relationship between the private, secret woman reader of the novel and a feeling that you can't control her, you can't force her to read in a particular way. It's just going to happen.
One of the other things I enjoyed in looking at the way that you tracked the rise of the woman reader was seeing the rise of all those bossy how-to books telling women what to do.
Yes. Well, yes, the conduct, they were known as conduct books, and they were first published in the late 16th century. And then, as you say, I mean, you could say that they still exist today. But they were books that told women how to be the perfect wife, how to run their household, how to treat their servants, how to be pious. And they're really extraordinarily dreary. And one of the things that I don't think I ever really discovered was to what extent they were actually read and taken seriously by women. So the only example I have of a woman who clearly didn't take them seriously was a woman called Jane Collier, who essentially wrote the first satire ever written by a woman. And it's called An Essay on the Art of Ingeniously Tormenting. And it's a kind of anti-contact book. So she must have read these contact books and thought, these are so tedious and dull and absurd. And so she wrote this wonderful parody, basically telling women, you know, how to be impossible and difficult and tormenting.
How much then do you see that history of anxiety about women's reading still with us? I mean, is it embedded in terms like chick lit or even with the meaning ascribed to things like Mills and Boone's novels?
Well, I think there is still a good deal of prejudice against women's writing, particular kinds of women's writing that are deemed to be mainly for a female readership, although we do know that actually a lot of this literature that's sort of deemed to be second rate, as you say, chick lit or commercial fiction, is actually read by men anyway. But I mean, I do think that we in England, in Europe, in Australia, in many parts of the world, the woman reader is now so privileged. We have access to anything and everything that we might want to read. And the internet, of course, has facilitated that in all sorts of extraordinary ways. We can order books, we can track down books that are out of print and buy them. So for many of us, I think, you know, despite the prejudice that you mention in relation to terms like chick lit, I do think we are immensely privileged, and it's extraordinary looking at the history of women to see how women have had to fight and struggle and persuade to ensure that in many parts of the world women do gain the same sort of education as men. But there are 800 million illiterate people in the world, and that was a statistic that shocked me deeply. I mean, that's a UNESCO projection for 2015, I think. Now, of that 800 million illiterate people, two-thirds of those are women. So there are millions and millions of women who are unable to read, and that's only the first step. It's not just a matter of being able to read, it's a matter of having access to reading material. And I am actually now working for two charities that promote women's literacy, or literacy in general, because I do feel deeply committed to literacy, and there's such a close connection between literacy and your economic status and your political involvement.
Belinda Jack speaking with Kate Evans. And The Woman Reader is published by Yale University Press. And there's a longer version of Kate's interview with Belinda online at the Books Plus website.